Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Fountain of Life Healing School. My name is Donna Crowe, and I'm the head teacher at Fountain Life Healing School. Fountain of Life Healing School is a nonprofit organization, and our purpose here is to talk about health. We're dedicated to your excellent health and to seeing people have the optimum health that they can have. And today we have Caroline Berenger back. She was with us about a month ago, and people really enjoyed the program, and so she's back. We both felt like we did a good job last time, but we felt like there was more material to cover, and so we're here again to share a little bit more. And so for those of you who are listening for the first time, didn't hear the last one, just want to let you know you can go to the same address and look through the archives. It's real close to the top. You can listen in there. But I'm also going to tell you a little bit about Caroline. For those who didn't listen to the last one or for those who are hearing this recording only, Caroline is the co-CEO and director of Immunutrition. That's a website, immunutrition.com. She's vice president of the Nutritional Therapy Association. She's board certified as, let me read this right. She's a board certified nutritional therapy practitioner. Yes. And she's also the East Coast lead instructor and master certified healing food specialist. And she's a published author, international health lecturer. She currently serves as an active board of directors member for the Nutritional Therapy Association. This little girl has got a schedule that would give a cowboy whiplash, but she's taking time out of her busy schedule, calling us from New York to share her heart and mind, and she's just a great resource for information on this particular subject and many others. But today we're talking about cultured foods. So hi, Caroline. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Donna. Thank you for having me back. I'm so excited to share more information about cultured foods.
Yeah, there's so much information. You think this would be a very simple topic, you know. It's good for you. Eat it, you know. But, one of the things we talked about last time, which people wrote and said that they had no idea, was that it is such a powerful healing food, that it's not just, oh, this is yummy stuff that you want to add to your diet because it's just fun, but it's powerfully healing. And we talked about, I'm just going to recap a little bit here for people. We talked about the immune system and that, you know, more than 80% of it is sort of housed in the environment of the gut, the lining of the gut and the positive probiotics, the positive bacteria, the healthy bacteria that's in the gut, that you need 4 to 5 pounds of those healthy bacteria in the gut, and they're instrumental in the immune system and in detoxing, in regulating hormones, just they affect your brain function, you know, your gut is the center of the universe in many ways for your physical body. and a simple imbalance of the probiotics opposed to the bad bacteria in your gut, simple imbalance of that one simple thing can cause a cascade in your body that is a downward spiral that makes you vulnerable to illness in a multitude of ways. So we also talked about the history of cultured foods, that it's almost fallen out of our consciousness. There's several generations of people who don't even know anything about it because all they've known is what they've eaten, and that's manufactured foods, stuff from the store. And so we're going to talk about today a number of things, but we're going to cover condiments, because condiments like mayonnaise, mustard, ketchup, these kind of things, they initially were fermented foods, but again, it wasn't convenient to market them as a fermented food, and so manufacturers created imitations of these. So I'm just going to stop right there and hand it over to Caroline and let her talk about this, because she knows way more about it than I do. So go for it, Caroline.
Well, I think we also wanted to discuss, if I'm not definitely the condiments, but also what cultures what. And
yes,
we'll kind of combine the two, Donna, and we'll talk about if we're going to make ketchup or if we're going to make mayonnaise or salsa or chutney or mustard or ketchup. Those are all wonderful condiments that you can put on the side of your plate. But, you know, some of them you might want to use a different starter or culture activator with. And one thing I notice in our certified healing food specialist trainings, which we'll talk about later, is we have a lesson on the culturing process and what cultures what, because they kind of overlap a little bit. You can use a commercial starter, powder starter. You could render your own whey, which we'll talk about today. You know, the kind of liquid, yellowy, greeny liquid that sits on top of your yogurt?
Yes.
That's called whey, and a lot of people don't even know what you can use that for, and they pour it off. But we'll discuss what whey is. But there's also other liquids and even spores and even something called a SCOBY, which we'll I'll tell you what that is, S-C-O-B-Y, later on. But all these things, they're all different ways to inoculate or start the culturing process. So what I'd like to do is just start a little bit about what the culturing process is, there are variables involved, what cultures what, and then tie in with what cultures what into how you would make that salsa, that mustard, that ketchup, or that mayo. Would that
excellent.
Be a okay.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm taking notes already.
I know, right? And these are things that we do teach in our chef's class, that Certified Healing Food Specialist class. So if you really want to get your hands on with that, that'd be something you might be interested in later on. We will talk about that. But one thing I also want to say is, please forgive me. I have a little bit of a cough that's lingering. So if I have to excuse myself for a moment and give a good cough, please bear with me, okay?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. Well, let's just talk a little bit and recap some of what we went and expand upon what we went over on the last interview.
Yeah.
Culturing or fermenting, those are interchangeable terms. They both mean that you either allow the microorganisms or the beneficial bacteria that are present in all of our fresh fruits and vegetables and other foods too, meats as well, and you either let that have a sort of a wild expression, meaning whatever is on that food can proliferate, multiply, and culture or ferment that food. But you can also add that inoculant in, that bacteria or yeast or a combination of that will either make a kefir or a yogurt. So it's called a wild fermentation, which is a great book by Sandor Katz, by the way. Or
okay.
There's a controlled version where you inoculate, kind of, bring in a bunch of organisms, an abundance of organisms that crowd out what would naturally be in the food or work synergistically with it to then culture the food. So it's kind of like the natural way, the wild way, and then there's a controlled sort of enhanced way.
Excellent.
So we'll talk about the differences between those. But just to digress back to the culturing process at the very beginning, you know, people need to understand that culturing is an art and a science. So it's kind of a little touch of experience mixed with just basic scientific processes that need to go on that make the culturing process happen. And as you said at the beginning of when you were doing the introduction, you were saying that you would think it would just be easy. And yes, it is. But having an understanding about how it works helps you troubleshoot if maybe things go a little bit wrong. Or, if you've never done this before, following directions can be easier than just kind of winging it. So it's an art and a science, and it's not exact every time, but it is a forgiving process. And there are lots of variables involved, which we'll talk about later in a little bit more depth, but those variables are the temperature in your home, the time needed for it to taste how you want it to taste and be fermented enough. There's emotional climate, and we talked about that before, and so on and so forth. And you've got to trust the process. If you're nervous or you're anxious about it, that can kind of interrupt the process a little bit. You also need to trust your taste buds and your nose, your olfactory system. If things smell bad or if they really taste awful, they shouldn't. They should be pleasantly tart. Cultured foods, that's a lactic acid process. meaning the bacteria divide and they have what is called a metabolite or a byproduct, I should say, which is lactic acid that they produce. And that's what makes the quintessential sour flavor of a cultured food be so and come about during the process. So if it really smells god-awful and there's
right.
funky things growing all over it and it smells awful, then you should throw that out and try another batch. That's why it's good to always start with a small batch first, test it out, test out the process, and don't be overly obsessive about sterilizing and stuff like that. We talked about that before. So just wanted to recap some of that so people will, if they didn't listen before or if they are going to jump in and try this, that they're reminded about these things.
And because I also want to mention, you know, that for someone who's never tried it at all, you can imagine sauerkraut. If you really hate sauerkraut, imagine sauerkraut only a milder form, because sauerkraut in the store tends to be pretty harsh. When you make this at home, you can kind of control the level of sourness a bit. You know, it doesn't have to be that extreme sourness that just puts your teeth on edge. So for people who think, well, I don't think I would like it, it's different. You should try it at least once and know that you can acquire a taste for it. And so I just wanted to mention that.
Well, a lot of the cultured foods that you'll find in the store, they've been pasteurized, as we talked about before.
Yes.
And then they add vinegar in to give it a sour flavor. And
exactly.
that's a lot what people don't like, is the real vinegary, like, oh, the back right where your jaw, right back by your ear where your jaw is, and it just bites and it hurts. Real cultured foods shouldn't have that kind of, that invasive kind of sour flavor. It's a very natural, lovely flavor. And like you said, depending on the time you allow it to culture, depends on how sour it will become. So that's a really good point, Donna.
So once it's got to a flavor that you like, you can refrigerate it and it slows that whole thing down, right?
Yes, but you want to keep your refrigerator at 38 degrees because 38 degrees is bacteria don't divide after about 39 degrees. So it'll stay where it's at in the culturing process. So get a little refrigerator thermometer and do that.
All righty.
All right, so what cultures what? Now, this is something that, you know, we get a lot of questions about. And it's a little confusing because, as I stated before, there are different ways to culture foods. And there are different, there are culture powders, culture grains, and I'm not talking about grains, G-R-A-I-N-S. I'm not talking about wheat grains or millet grains. I'm talking about things that look like little grains of rice, but they're really yeasts. So when I say culturing grains, I don't want you to think, you know, carbohydrate-based grains that you eat. These are little pieces that look like rice or cauliflower, and they're yeast colonies. So that's what I mean by that. And then there are mats that are called mushrooms to make kombucha, which is a fermented or cultured tea. And it looks like just a rounded disc. It doesn't look anything like a mushroom at all. And yeast and mold spores, and then the wild natural approach. So let's go through each of these.
Excellent.
Okay. Let's say, for example, one thing I do want to say before we start is that this is an individually based process. If you choose to culture or ferment foods the wild way, then if that resonates with you, that's wonderful. If it doesn't and you choose to go a more commercial starter route, there's really no right or wrong way. Some people who are real purists say, you know, oh, the powders have bad things in them, and the you know, if you buy the liquids, they're manufactured cultured foods. Well, all I have to say is if they taste good and they're living and it's bubbly and tingling on your tongue or the liquid
right.
Or the powder comes from a trusted source, it doesn't matter what kind of culture activator you use. It's whatever works with your lifestyle. Because think about it. If you're a busy person, which many of us are, then let's say you're an executive and you're not going to have time to render your own way, which we'll talk about first. And you're not going to have time to necessarily wait for a SCOBY to grow and to keep an eye on your kombucha because you're rarely home. Excuse me one minute. So that might be something where a commercial starter that you could even take with you on the road in a little foil packet that it comes in will serve you. And while you're traveling, you can make your own yogurt, or you could make your own coconut kefir, which is a water-based kefir fermentation process. So I just don't want anybody to feel that any one of these activators is better than the other. It's just when we look at lifestyle and we look at even temperature in the home or altitude, things are different. So some work better for others than some, and some work better for others. It's just, it's a bio-individual thing. Excuse me. So let's talk about whey. Whey is a protein portion of milk. And it could be goat's milk, cow's milk, sheep's milk, regardless, and it's human milk too. There's whey, human whey. So you want a high-quality whey. And what do I mean by high quality? Well, the whey that most people think of is a byproduct of cheese making. And the cheese making is usually, there could be involved some high temperatures that we boil the milk at, that can damage the whey proteins. So when you want to make your whey, the best thing to do is to take a high-quality, full-fat yogurt. And it can be a yogurt from raw milk or pasteurized milk, a quality, like 7 Stars, I think, that has a pretty quality product. And you're going to line a strainer with cheesecloth. What is cheesecloth? Well, go Google it. You'll see it. Wikipedia actually has pictures of cheesecloth. It is a cheese-making product, but you could also line your fine wire mesh strainer with a towel, a kitchen towel, or several layers of unbleached paper towels. And you're going to take the strainer and line it with whatever you can find that will sometimes a kitchen towel really does work quite well. And you'll take the yogurt, and I would start with a quart of yogurt, and that's 32 ounces, and I would dump that into the strainer with the towel or the paper towels or the cheesecloth, and then put it into and over a vessel that will catch the dripping whey liquid. It's that kind of yellowy liquid that is sort of covering the top of yogurt or kefir sometimes even. And kefir will separate into curds and whey. Your little Miss Muffet sat on her tuffet eating curds and whey, right? So if you let your kefir yogurt go longer and culture, the whey curds, the casein curds, which is casein is also a protein in milk. It's something that some people are very sensitive to. So you have casein protein and whey protein. They're two different proteins in milk products. When you're collecting that whey, it's usually quite clear and slightly yellow. That's a very living whey because most of the time, yogurt doesn't have to be heated at high temperatures like cheese making. So you can take this whey and it'll hold in your refrigerator at 38 degrees or even a little higher, whey will, for many, many months. And you can use it to make salsa, mayonnaise, and all the cultured foods. You can even make more cultured vegetables with it. You can add a sauerkraut, we call cultured vegetables at Immunutrition. So whey is very versatile. It's sort of, think of it as, and that's why I started with it first, it's the most universal culture activator out there. And it's probably the easiest to get and the most cheap to render. Because a thing of yogurt might be $6 or $7, where culture powders and grains and other ones that you buy that are commercially prepared can be quite expensive, and they're maybe used one time to culture one batch, where the whey can go on and culture many successive batches because you don't need a lot of it, and you'll render a lot from a quart size of yogurt.
All right, so it stores for a long time. Once mm-hmm. you've separated the whey from the yogurt, what do you do with the yogurt?
Well, that's Greek yogurt. It depends on how long you let it strain. So, for example, if you let it strain a good couple of days in the fridge, then you'll have a nice farmer's cheese that you can add chives and garlic and onion and veggies, shredded veggies to, even put in some of your live sauerkraut into that cheese and make a dip out of it for a crudité. You can even spread it on, add it to your pesto and spread it on a sandwich with some pesto and have like a cheese. You could let it go further and become more of a cheese, but that's in cheese making is a different art altogether. So it's a little bit out of the scope of this conversation.
But you can just eat it. You don't just toss it out. You eat. It's still a viable, good food with the whey removed. It's basically Greek yogurt, is what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. Greek yogurt maybe in 24 hours, and then if you let it drip even more, it would be more like a cheese spread.
Cheese spread. Okay.
And you can put that on lox. You can grate some lemon zest into that that cheese. And you can put in capers and sea salt, maybe Herbes de Provence, which is a beautiful sea salt that has a different flavor to it, and put it on some lox, some smoked salmon.
I'm coming to your house, Caroline.
Oh, yeah, we have a lot of fun things going here. So think of whey as your universal inoculant or culture starter or culture activator. Those words are all interchangeable as well. The only thing is that if you do have a dairy allergy, if you're sensitive to milk and you're sensitive to butter and those kinds of things and cheese, you may not do so well with whey. I don't. And usually I will go for a commercial starter over whey because of my sensitivity. So I just want you to, if you think you have a whey sensitivity, there's an easy way, no pun intended, to tell. All you need to do is take some of the whey, if you've rendered it, and rub some on your forearm and let it really sit there. You could even take some of the cheese that's left over and make a paste out of the whey and the cheese and let it dry on your forearm. This is the Gut and Psychology Syndrome Diet by Dr. Natasha Campbell McBride. She does the patch tests. And if you before you go to bed, put that whey and dairy on your skin. Because they're both protein, it won't matter really which one you react to because it's just one and the same pretty much. And if you in the morning you wake up and you have a red ring all around or a pink ring all around that patch, most likely whey might not be your best choice for a culture activator.
Excellent. Good information.
Yeah.
Also, for me, I just do terrible with pasteurized dairy, but with raw dairy I don't have a problem. So that's something to consider too. If you like dairy but don't do well on it, if it's pasteurized that you're having a problem with, you might want to consider trying raw and see if you do fine,
And you know what, Donna? I'm the exact opposite. I do better with pasteurized than raw.
That's really unique.
I think there's an antibody that was formed back somewhere with my great-grandmother with raw dairy that my grandmother, my mother, and I have.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
Yeah, I actually, and there's another thing I'd like to share too, while we're speaking on food sensitivities, because you do want to be careful. You don't want to be eating a lot of what you're sensitive to. It's very disruptive to the immune system, and it can cause a whole host of issues like eczema and hives and sneezing and runny nose and those kinds of things, unpleasant side effects. So what you can do is, there's a doctor named Dr. Coca, C-O-C-A, like Coca-Cola, but no cola afterwards. Dr.
Right.
Coca was a doctor in the early part of the, I believe it was the 19th or 20th century, I don't remember. I should know that. Who created the Coca's pulse testing, where you would actually be able to tell whether you were sensitive or intolerant to a food or allergic by your heartbeat. And there's a really easy way, and it's a much more... I believe, accurate way than the scratch testing that they do or the prick testing for allergies.
Yes,
and
I
what
agree.
You can, yeah. And all you need to do is for 60 seconds, so one full minute, take your pulse while you're sitting down. It's important that you sit down so that you can be in parasympathetic or relaxed mode. When you're in sympathetic or fight or flight, your heartbeat's going to naturally be higher. So sit down, take a few breaths, and take your pulse for one full minute. You can take it at the jugular vein or the artery in your neck, excuse me, or you can take it on the wrist, but do it with on the side of the wrist that's the same side as your thumb. So if you take your left hand and you put your palm to the ceiling, and then take your right hand and trace from the tip of your to your tongue, your thumb, all the way down to right near where you're, you'll feel a nice pulse, right there. Take that for 60 seconds and mark down. Let's say it's 68 beats per minute. Then take whatever food or supplement or substance that you it could be your toothpaste, it could be your mouthwash. Don't just limit it to food. It could be anything that you're actually putting in your mouth, and toothpaste and mouthwash are very common, and they have bad ingredients in them. So take that and put it in your mouth and hold it on your tongue and taste it. Don't just kind of sit there and hold it. Taste it, but don't swallow it for 30 seconds. Then retake your pulse for 60 seconds while you hold it in your mouth after that 30 seconds. The 30 seconds is to give your body some, to give you an idea of how to, your brain needs to register what's on your tongue and talk to the organs and glands in the immune system, and then it's a feedback loop. It comes back with an answer. And the answer is a change in your heartbeat that second time you take the pulse. So if, let's say, for example, it was 68 the first time, and I'm going to put some whey into my mouth, hold it there, I'm going to taste it for 30 seconds, keep holding it in my mouth, do not swallow it, take my pulse an additional 60 seconds while I'm sitting down the entire time, and let's say my pulse goes to 80, which, by the way, it'll go up 22 points for me. If your pulse increases, even if it's 6 points or more, that is showing allergic tension to something. So I think it's really good to mention this, that you can do this with anything.
Yes, and you save yourself a lot of suffering by, not putting it in your body. This is a way to test and let your body tell you, instead of putting it all the way through your digestive system and letting your body tell you that way. It's a lot more stressful that way.
And a lot of people, when they eat out and they eat at a friend's house and there's maybe MSG in something, or they've microwaved the food, or whatever impurities may be in the food from however they prepared it, bad ingredients or bad cooking materials, your pulse will, a lot of people say, I go out to eat and my heart rate goes up. That's because something in the food you're not normally eating at home, or the way it was prepared, is bothering you. And your heartbeat will let you know.
You're,
and Dr. Coca discovered this. Yeah.
Basically having an allergic response, and your heart is responding.
Mm-hmm. Your heartbeat will tell you a lot. It's not just a pump, ladies and gentlemen. It is so much more. It's
absolutely
even involved with your memory. So it's we learn it by heart. We don't learn it by brain. We learn it by heart. So it's got a lot of functions other than just moving around your blood in your body.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that's how you would determine if whey would be something you're sensitive to. But it really is the most universal of all culture activators. Then we've got culture powders. And you can buy these pretty much. There's yogurt starters in your store. There's a Body Ecology and Dr. Mercola's probiotics. You can open up capsules of probiotics and use them as, quote, activators or inoculants. And you can use, there's Wilderness Family Naturals, wildernessfamilynaturals.com. They also have culture starters there. Cultures for Health. I think if you really want to go learn about all the different kinds of activators and read about them, culturesforhealth.com, I can't say enough about. They have videos to teach you how to culture things. They tell you all about the species that are in the cultures. It's such a wonderful educational website for you to learn about culture activators. So go take a look.
culturesforhealth.com, and the other one was Wilderness Family
Naturals.
Naturals.com.
Mm-hmm.
I know we have people listening that it's difficult. So it's wildernessfamilynaturals.com.
It's plural, naturals, yes, .com.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And culturesforhealth.com. Okay, go ahead.
Those are two of the really wonderful resources that are out there. There's also Kombucha Camp, which we'll talk about later, to make kombucha. We'll tell you how to spell that and go there later, but that's when we'll talk about SCOBYs. So the culture powders, these are freeze-dried microbes. So they are dried, freeze-dried. They are gently dried because we don't want to harm them. They are taken from non-dairy sources in some instances and dairy sources in other instances. So you need to ask the company who's made the commercial starter powder the question, does your powder have milk in it, dried powder milk? Does it have genetically modified organisms in it, maybe corn glucose, because sometimes they'll put sugar into these culture powders, these commercial powders. Now, I know Cultures for Health and Wilderness Family Naturals, they are very clean, natural products if you can't use whey. I use those. And since I'm so whey and dairy sensitive, the culture powders give me absolutely no problem at all. That doesn't mean that it may not be that way for someone else, because we're all bio-individuals. So the culture powders are dry, and you can take them with you, and they're dried at a very low temperature, and they're made into a powder, and they're put into usually a carrier powder, which can be something like inulin, which is a prebiotic. It's a fiber from usually from the chicory root, and it serves to feed the freeze-dried microbes when they wake up. And when you add a culture powder to a water medium or a milk medium, a wet medium, they wake up. They're reconstituted, and then the microbes wake up, and they look around, and they say, what do I have to eat here? And that's called a prebiotic. That's food for a probiotic. And some powders have this built in. And you just want to make sure what's in those powders is something that you're not intolerant to. You could make a paste of the powder, put it on your arm, wake up in the morning and see if there's a red ring and know that you can use that powder or not.
Excellent.
Simple way. Mm-hmm. So you can take these powders and you can add them to culture salsa. Any of the condiments that we're going to talk about, you could use these culture starters. You can do the same thing with whey. So culture powders are also a bit universal. Yet there is a distinction sometimes that they won't make yogurt. They'll make kefir, they'll make sour cream, they will make a lot of different milk products, butter, but yogurt is a bit of a different approach. And we'll cover that in a moment when we get to the actual foods and what cultures what, but I just want to make that distinction right now that not all culture powders will make yogurt. You may need a, quote, yogurt starter to do that. Or it could come in powder form, that yogurt starter, or it could come just from using already fermented cultured yogurt. You can use the food itself, once you've cultured it, to make more in most cases. And we'll go over that in a moment. Then there are culture grains. And again, I don't mean, go eat rice kind of grains or millet or quinoa.
Right.
They're small pieces and they look like grains. And if you've ever made kefir, I don't know if anybody has on that's listening on the call, kefir grains, there are water kefir grains and dairy kefir grains. You would not use water grains to culture dairy or dairy grains to culture water-based things. Now, people are probably saying, you culture water? Uh-huh, you can. You can take water with a little lemon juice and add some honey, put in some of your water grains, and Cultures for Health has those kefir water grains, and make water kefir. That was kind of, if you think about it, if you were a cave person and you're walking around, and you, maybe a tree had a little cutout in it and some rainwater collected there, and some honeybees, or the tree had some sap that dripped into it, and that would be the sugar that would feed the microbes that are naturally in the wood of the tree, in the air, coming on the breeze and the dust that kind of washes in, that goes over that little area where the water is being held in that tree trunk, and it became a cultured beverage. This is what we had before
That sounds so fun. It's like... We were walking through the woods, and there were little fairies there, and we found this wonderful drink in the tree,
this was our cultured food, and
I
this
love
is what
that.
We did before we had fire. So, with water kefir, you can just use water, but then there's coconut water too, and you can render that the young green coconut. You'll see them in markets where the green coconut's usually very, very large. It's like the size of a humongous bowling ball, but they machete all of the outside off and make it this little thing
right.
with a point on the top, right? Well,
right.
That's coconut water, which is very electrolyte rich, meaning it's got minerals that are really good for keeping conductivity in your body the highest potential of conductivity in your blood. Okay, so we are electrical beings, so we need those spark plugs, those electrolytes, and coconut water is full of them. So coconut water, you could either use a powdered kefir commercial starter, or you could use the kefir water grains.
They're fairly
easy to care for. You just need to follow the directions that come with your kefir grains. Now, usually water kefir grains come dehydrated, and you'll have to rehydrate them, and then you'll have to keep them alive by feeding them. See, this is the difference between the powders. You use once, and you use another packet the next time, or you use some of that batch to make the next batch. That's called transferring. But with grains, they're ongoing. They're living little clusters of organisms, yeasts, and a little bacteria in there, and you need to feed them. So let's say, for example, you made coconut kefir water, and you used your water grains. Well, when your coconut kefir water tastes like you want it to taste, which is like a coconutty effervescent champagne that's sour, you would strain out your grains, put them in some more water, and feed them something, like a little drop of honey, put a piece of dried fruit in, because when they run out, because water has no nutritional value, it has no prebiotics or food in there for the organisms in the grains. So you need to be able to feed them. So there's more maintenance involved with the grains. But if you get you'll get your groove, and you'll know, okay, this batch is ready, so I'm going to take my grains out, strain them, put them in new water, give them some food, and put them in the fridge. And
Absolutely. That's
what you do. And you put them in the fridge to slow down their multiplication. And if they don't multiply, they won't eat as much and as quickly. So that drop of honey you put in there could last for a week or two, because they're kind of asleep. They're very slow. And that's why it's important to put them in the fridge. So there's also kefir grains for dairy. So if you use it for goat milk or cow's milk or sheep's milk or almond milk, or if you make homemade almond milk, or even soy milk. I know soy isn't that great of a food for you, but if you fermented soy, it actually, it can be healthful. If you ferment soy like miso or natto, we'll talk about that in a minute. So the milk grains, you have to do the same thing. They look like little clusters of cauliflower. If you just want to go Google kefir water grains and kefir milk grains, tons of pictures will come up if you choose the images link when you do a Google search, because there's images and websites and things, and you'll see lots of different grains out there. But the milk kefir grains also need to be fed and maintained. I have killed many a grain, and I feel awful. I actually got one to rejuvenate. It rose from the dead, and I kept feeding it and feeding it and feeding it and feeding it, and it came to life again. So they're quite hardy.
They are really hardy. I mean, I've been pretty abusive on some of them, and I've had some that I left in my fridge in milk for like a year, and I went back and filtered it, and they were still in there, and they were fine. So I was pretty amazed by that.
That's why I say this is a forgiving process, and these microbes, they have to withstand all the changes of the seasons and go without food possibly, and they have to hang on. It's their job to do so and clean up our environment. So, if you let them go a little longer, but know that to ideally, you do want to make sure every week that you feed them.
Yeah,
like having another animal.
We don't recommend grain abuse.
No grain abuse, exactly. So powders, again, and grains are a little bit different, and so is whey. You have to find out what works for you. Now, let's say you're wanting to make kombucha, which is that fermented tea I spoke about before. Kombucha Camp, and camp is with a K, so K-O-M-B-U-C-H-A, K-O-M as in Mary, B as in boy, U-C-H-A, Camp. K as in kite, A, M as in Mary, P as in Paul. KombuchaCamp.com. They have starter kits, and they have education, out the wazoo. I mean, you could go and read on that Kombucha Camp and the Cultures for Health site. Like, it would take you weeks to read through all the information that's on those wonderful sites. But what cultures kombucha or tea into kombucha is a SCOBY, S-C-O-B-Y, symbiotic colony of bacteria and yeast, SCOBY. So you would use the, some people call them a mushroom. Again, it is not a mushroom at all. It just kind of looks like one, but it doesn't have a stem. It looks like the top of a mushroom, and it doesn't have, and it's not as thick, but and it doesn't have a stem. So you would use these SCOBYs to add it to freshly brewed and cooled black tea, add a prebiotic, which is some sugar, throw in your SCOBY. You can buy one online, or a friend may have some baby SCOBYs that you can add to your ferment, your cooled tea and sugar, and then you're going to leave it from anywhere from probably 8 days to 15 to 20 days, depending on the variables we talked about at the beginning of the call, the variable of time and temperature and emotional climate and so on and so forth. So kombucha should taste nice, like a nice sour tea, and not soured as in a bad iced tea from, like, I'm from the South, and when tea used to sour, it was pretty nasty. But this is something that's quite pleasant, and it's quite astringent, and it clears your palate nicely, and it's also a digestive aid. It's a wonderful beverage. So, the SCOBY would be something that you could Google and see pictures of. There's lots of them out there, and they look a little bit alien-like when you're not used to them, kind of like a jellyfish, right, Donna?
Yeah, very much so. They're just flat. I mean, they grow to the size of the container. They're completely flat. They're sort of an opaque, they almost look like plastic, like Lucite or something like that. They're opaque and kind of slippery licking. But kombucha is just really delicious to me. I find it extremely tasty. It's sometimes, or quite frequently, I feel like I'm pretty fortunate with it, but it will, it'll become carbonated. And so it's a nice fizzy drink. In fact, Coca-Cola, again, initially was a fermented drink, and, you know, exploding bottles in transit, they again figured out how to imitate kombucha, or naturally carbonated Coca-Cola, and turned it into artificially carbonated, which doesn't ferment. It's not like a process that continues after they've packaged it. So what you have now is artificial carbonated drinks, but initially they were kombucha-type drinks that people were drinking and they were health-promoting. The imitation stuff in the store is loaded with sugar, and it's just not real food. It's imitation food.
Absolutely, and that's a good segue into the next set of, we've talked about so far, whey, culture powders, culture grains, SCOBYs. Well, let's talk about cultured liquids, because there are pre-cultured liquids out there that you can purchase. One of my favorite companies that does this is realfoodreallife.tv, as in television, but that's not what it stands for. So realfoodreallife.tv. My friend Tamara has a company that makes these delicious probiotic liquids, and they're really supplements. They're not meant to be consumed in big 8-ounce glasses. A 2-ounce serving gives you billions of organisms. So she has a lime mint, which I call a projito, and she has a grapefruit and a great grains, G-R-A-I-N-S, and it is cultured with some millet and quinoa. And these are wonderful to make salad dressings with, but you can also use them as a culturing activator.
Okay, and so they can be a supplement to your probiotic diet, or you can use them as starters.
Exactly.
Okay.
And it's just like you would use whey, or just like you would use... just whey, because that's the liquid. You would use a couple of, maybe an ounce, and if you wanted to make sauerkraut and you wanted to add, let's say, the lime mint drink in, you would use about a 2-ounce shot glass within a whole quart of sauerkraut, And, you know, you can toss it around in that liquid before you put it into the jar and mash it down tightly. You always pack sauerkraut very tightly and under the brine. So if you take that 2 ounces of the liquid, pour it over your shredded cabbage, toss it like a salad, get it all coated with that liquid, mash it into your jar. You can buy a kraut pounder, K-R-A-U-T-P-O-U-N-D-E-R, krautpounder.com. They look like mini baseball bats, and you and get a wide mouth mason jar so you can do this, and pack that cabbage in there, and then if there's any liquid that needs to be added, you just put some water over the top, and you can sprinkle a little salt in there too if you wish. It's very easy, but those liquids...
Basically, when you say if there's any liquid that needs to be added, that's determined by the fact that you want the cabbage to be completely submersed, right?
Anaerobic, yes, underwater. Mm-hmm.
Right.
That's how you keep your... anything you culture should be, if it's veggies or chutney or salsas, always keep everything under water. So if you add whey to make your salsa, we're going to go all through this in a minute and go over. I'm just explaining all the different culture activators, and then I'm going to go through what cultures what. And that doesn't take very long at all. So so you would use these liquids as you would whey, and they're wonderful.
You're talking about the lime mint right now. Is this going to cause it to have a different flavor?
Not much. Mm-mm. No, because you're only using 2 ounces, and it has
a very mild
lime mint, yes.
But
think of how delicious that would be in the summer to have like a lime mint a sauerkraut. It'd probably be good with watermelon.
So if you were making cabbage, could you throw some lime and some mint in there?
Yes, but I would just do a little bit because lime can get very bitter. And I wouldn't use the rind at all. I wouldn't zest it. I just squeeze some in there, and maybe 1 leaf of mint.
Okay.
Yeah. The same with any kind of herbs.
While we're on the subject, is there anything that you absolutely should not ferment, as far as food goes? You know, as far as vegetables
some of it, like broccoli. Doesn't do too well. Okra doesn't do too well. You can add some broccoli in, but it can be very overpowering. It's more the flavor. I think you can ferment anything because you can ferment fish, you can ferment meat, you can ferment lemons and limes. They're just like preserved naturally in the brine when you culture them, and they're soft, and you can add them to salad dressings and things. I mean, there are some great books out there I want to mention at the end, so to give you some great recommendations for all of that. So then let's say you wanted to make miso. Well, miso uses a spore, and it's called a koji, K-O-J-I. You can get koji spores and boil your own soybeans. You boil them, let them cool, process them into a paste, and add in your inoculant, which would be the koji spore. And you would make, allow it to sit and culture, and there's going to be a black liquid that is a byproduct of the culturing process, and that's tamari sauce. So you can pour off that black liquid and use that in your Asian cooking, right, and have or use it in the salad dressing even. It kind of tastes like a bit like Bragg's Aminos or a nice wheat-free tamari sauce. And then you would have the miso paste that should be kind of light and fluffy, and you'll add that to, of course, some hot water and have miso soup and add in your seaweed. So you can make your own miso, but I have to tell you, not a lot of people do because there's really good stuff out there on the market.
There is. How long would that process take?
It's anywhere from 7 to 14 days.
Okay.
Yeah. And, of course, then there's the natural approach. No culture activator at all. And Anne Wigmore, who's no longer with us, but she was an amazing lady, she created something called the Living Food Lifestyle. And it was using, like, say, for example, you wanted to make what she called veggie kraut, which, of course, is root vegetables and makes it into a sauerkraut. And she would slice up all her veggies and just say, cover it with water and put a plate on top of the whatever was in the jar. She actually used a pot. So she put a plate on top and then fill it with water, fill a jar with water and have a weight that holds that plate that's and it submerges under the juice, and it keeps all the veggies smashed down under that plate in the big pot. And that would take about 2 weeks. Please note that when you do a natural or a wild fermentation, it can take quite a bit longer than when you assist it by adding a culture activator.
Absolutely, because these probiotics, a lot of people don't know, but those probiotics are floating in the air around us. And so
everywhere, yes.
Yeah, so the probiotics that are in the air will be the culture starter for, you know, what she's talking about here. And obviously that's going to be sort of a milder level of inoculation compared to a packet that's just loaded full of it.
Yes. I mean,
so it would take a little bit longer.
Right. It takes a little longer to get going because you're not adding in like this army of microbes to go in and just start eating away at the cabbage, which would be a prebiotic. The sugars in the carrots, the sugars in the cabbage, all the fibers act as prebiotics, which are food for the good bacteria, the probiotics. And every fruit and every veggie, and they all have microbes on them. We just don't see them. And our, you know, now that we're messing with our soil, the microbes are not as abundant in the soil anymore. So, you know, if you have your own garden and you don't have a lot of weeds and you have a very balanced or a nice yield harvest, then you know you're doing the right thing and you're getting a lot of microbes in that soil on your food. And those are soil organisms, and they are very, very important to our health because we are more organism than we are human.
Yeah, it's amazing to think that there are more good bacteria in your gut than there are cells in your body.
Yep.
That's quite something.
A 10-to-1 ratio.
Yeah,
excuse me,
it's really quite remarkable. I just wanted to do a little backwards step here just for a moment. We were talking about the kefir grains and that you could do water kefir or dairy kefir. I've also used kefir grains to ferment raw apple juice, and oh my gosh, talk about something that's incredibly delicious. I highly recommend it. It is unbelievably tasty.
So you're making your own apple cider kind of?
Yeah, very, very, very tasty.
Oh, I could use a glass of that right now. That sounds divine. Oh, boy. Well, so, and just to keep, I want to make sure we have all the time we can to talk about those condiments, Donna. I'm going to really quickly go over the shelf life of these activators that I've just mentioned. And that way people can feel comfortable the way culture powders, the grains, the SCOBY, the spores, and of course the natural approach, we won't go over that. But whey can last for literally months. If you keep your refrigerator nice and cool, 38 degrees, it keeps all of your other food in your refrigerator keeps it from molding. So your leftovers even last longer, your leftover foods. Whey can last from 6 months to a year. The activator powders, well, you know, the powders kind of have the longest shelf life, but you do want to check to see if they have an expiration date because some of them do. They're usually a year or two out. I don't recommend freezing culture powders. Refrigeration would be fine. So just put those little sachets, those foil sachets, into the fridge, and that's fine. Now, of course, the grains or the clumps of yeast and bacteria, they are higher maintenance, and they get easily contaminated if you don't care for them properly, especially when you keep opening and closing them and using them and using them and you're not real careful. Best to dehydrate them, then reconstitute them. So you can, I have a friend of mine who takes her grains, they're water grains, they're not milk grains. Sometimes she'll do this with the milk grains, but when she travels, she finds that she can make coconut kefir more easily than she can some of her dairy items because she doesn't have a refrigerator. So she will take her grains and just cover them with rapadura sugar. What is rapadura? It's dehydrated cane juice. It has all of its mineral and vitamin profile. So it doesn't steal anything from your body like refined sugar does. Refined sugar takes all the good nutrients out and just leaves the sweet flavor. And then you have to use your mineral and vitamin reserves in your body to even process that processed sugar. But rapadura has its full nutritional profile, and that feeds the microbes. So what she does is she just kind of, you know how you take a piece of chicken and you dip it in some egg and you flour it on either side, and it kind of sticks to it, that's what she does. She just keeps a little baggie or a jar and just takes and rolls her grains all around with sugar and doesn't even keep them in solution. She just lets the sugar, they don't dry out. It's very, very interesting.
That's
so
fun. That's great.
Yeah, you might try that.
And sugar is so antibacterial. It would be like a preservative. So, yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it really works for her. Now let's talk about those. And the grains, really, there isn't an expiration date unless you just don't care for them properly or you just let them fully die out, you know, for years in your fridge. But they're very, very easy to reconstitute. And you can use a dehydrator if you put your grains on a dehydrator tray at a very low temperature, you know, maybe under 110 degrees, you can dehydrate them and then store them in an airtight container in the fridge and then reconstitute them as needed. So there's ways around all of this stuff. That's why it's a forgiving process.
I wanted to make a clarification here for people. You said that whey powder is like a universal starter.
Whey liquid.
I mean whey liquid, excuse me. But obviously that doesn't work for kombucha.
No.
Okay,
nope.
So it's universal, but not with kombucha.
Exactly, yes.
Okay.
And I'll that's what I'm going to run through in just after I explain this next one.
Okay.
Activator liquids. Now, remember, liquids in their true state, like water or coconut water, they only have a small amount of nutrition within that water. So the microbes run out of a food source quite quickly with these liquids. So like my friend's liquids, they'll last a couple of months in the fridge as a living liquid. Then you can still use it because dead but good bacteria aid living good bacteria. So it's okay. It's called a metabiotic. We talked about this on the last call. Dead bacteria are all right. Like sourdough bread, it comes from a live starter, but then it's heated. But there's still good beneficial properties to sourdough bread, if it's made with the proper flour, that aid the good bacteria inside you. The dead bacteria do. So with liquids, they have the shortest shelf life. You want to use those in a couple of weeks. If you don't want them to die, you can add in a couple of raisins into the bottle. And then that's prebiotics, and sugar is food for probiotics. So you can keep your liquids alive longer, but know that they continue to culture and get more sour and more sour. And especially with coconut water, you can have coconut moonshine. Remember we mentioned that on the last one?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so or your apple juice. You'll end up with, you know, apple liqueur, apple alcohol. You know, because the more fruits that we use in our inoculants, the more alcohol that is produced because there's so much sugar in fruit. And then spores. Spores free. So if you're going to use those koji spores to make your miso or even other kinds of spores or molds to make even natto, which is the soybeans that they're kind of slimy and they taste like blue cheese. Natto, N-A-T-T-O, is a very, what's it called when you... acquired taste.
Yes, absolutely.
But if you want to read more about natto, since it's not as popular or easy to make, you can order natto online. There is a great provider up here in the Northeast. I can't remember his name. I feel terrible right now. But you can read about natto all over the web, and it's just very, very interesting. It's very thick and gooey and blue cheesy tasting. But the spores freeze well. Spores do very, very well for long periods of time. So if you want to make your miso and you have leftover spore inoculant, you can freeze that. But your liquid, you always want to... Okay, sorry.
On the topic of freezing, I had one person listen to the last broadcast and wanted to know, once he had fermented vegetables from his organic garden, are they freezable?
No.
Okay.
In 2 weeks, pretty much all the microbes will be gone. And when he thaws them out and defrosts those frozen veggies, they're going to be really slimy and odd because the cellulose will have collapsed within within the cabbage. I don't recommend that at all, no.
Okay, don't freeze. All right.
And, of course, you don't want to heat any of these. You don't want to be cooking your whey or heating up your milk kefir and boiling it. You're going to kill all the organisms. These are living foods that shouldn't be put really near any kind of heat.
Right. good.
Okay, so what culture is what? And we have don't we have about a half an hour, Donna?
We do. And can we just take a break here just briefly? Because I know this is like so much information for people, and I know some people are going, I want to know more. So can you talk about your school a bit?
Oh, sure. That'll give everybody's brain a break. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I do teach for the Nutritional Therapy Association. That's the first school that I teach for. And it's a 9-month program. There's an NTC, Nutritional Therapy Consultant, and an NTP, Nutritional Therapy Practitioner program. The NTC program is more for people who they might want to work with long-distance clients. You learn a lot about the consultation process and how to focus on foundational pillars of health. Our 6 foundations are diet, digestion, blood sugar, fatty acids, hydration, and minerals. And we teach you how to look at a person within the scope of those 6 foundations. Because if those 6 foundations are in place, you have a balanced body chemistry and you have a balanced individual. When they cascade out of balance, they move into more hormonal issues and cardiovascular disease and diabetes and immune problems, lots of food allergies and sensitivities, and the need for the body to the need for assisted detoxification because the body can't really do it on its own anymore. It's compromised. So that's the NTC program. The NTP program is just like the NTC program, but the NTP program is for people who want to learn more functional nutrition by using the body. So there's hands-on assessment of functional nutrition that we teach you in the NTP program. You can take the program in 2 parts. You can start out as an NTC, get your feet wet, open up a practice, start consulting with people about nutritional therapy, and then bring in the functional piece and take that and add that to your skill set later. Or you can jump right into the NTP program and take that as an advanced program with both of those aspects in there.
Are either of these programs something that people could do long distance, or is this on-site? How does this go?
It's long distance, but yet you meet, it's called distance learning, but you do meet 3 times in the NTP program, where the more advanced, where you have the hands-on functional, you meet 3 times over a 9-month period at a designated location to learn the hands-on and for the instructors to see you doing that so you leave the program knowing what the heck you're doing. The NTC program, because it doesn't have any kind of the functional evaluation portion of it, the hands-on assessment, it's all about the client consultation process and examining food journals and learning how to interview and motivating your client to make change rather than telling them, shaking a finger at them. You know, nobody wants to hear, you need to do this. You want your client to say, I need to do this, and how can you
very
help
good.
Me?
That's very
yes.
good.
Yes.
And your website is Immunutrition, which is I-M-M-U-N. immunutrition.com. If you go to her site, she has a link up at the top that says education, and there's a drop-down menu, and you can get more information about those classes there.
Yes. And then my own class that I created also worked with my business partner, Jennifer, in Immunutrition. We created the Chef's Program, CHFS. We call it affectionately the Chef's Program, and it's a certified healing food specialist training. This is a 4-day live intensive. Oh, and by the way, the NTC people, just to digress, they meet 1 time over the 9 months.
Okay.
Just 1 time, just so you know that. But the Chef's training, to go back to that, it's a 4-day intensive program. There is on the website, if you go to immunutrition.com, half the word immunity, half the word nutrition. And if you go there and go to that education tab, like in the main menu, like Donna just stated, and you go down and the first link is the chef's training, you'll see about mid-page, if you scroll down, you'll see an pre-recorded information session that I recorded all about the chef's training. And we have a very much an emphasis on all the cultured foods, like we're talking about on this call today. And we teach you about bone broth and all different kinds of things to do with traditional cooking. There's a knife skills portion of the class. And it's all about getting really in touch with the food, because the NTC and the NTP programs are more of a clinical side. And we definitely touch on food in that program. It's very much based on Weston A. Price principles and Sally Fallon's work. But in the chef's class, we actually get in and we have some demoing, some hands-on tastings, and we get it's all centered around food itself. So that program may become part of the nutritional therapy program. We're working on that to see if we can integrate it. It would be beautiful. They would marry quite well. So that's something that you might see change in a little bit. But we do have a chef's program coming up in Chicago in September and in California in October, but you can look at the dates online. We already had our New York training. It was very successful. We graduated, I think, about 20 chefs, and we keep it small. We keep the class about no more than 20 to 23 people to keep that nice learning environment in place.
I see it goes from like a Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
Yeah.
So it's a four-day class, so it's 40 hours, so those are nice 10-hour days. Those are good.
Right. Well, those are 8-hour days, but we have three required conference calls spaced 2 weeks apart.
Got
before
it.
You even meet at class, and there's an
okay.
activity that you can take up to 3 months. You have to do a public awareness activity. You have to go out and bring information you've learned in the class to your community, and we have evaluations for you to give your guests to your public awareness activity, and that's proof that you did it, and we have you tell us all about it in an essay.
That's
and
wonderful.
Then you're certified, yes.
That's awesome, Caroline. I love that.
Yeah.
That's the way to get the message out.
Well, yeah. I mean, what did Weston A. Price say? You teach, you teach, you teach. And
yes,
the more
yes.
we teach others, the more they're empowered with information. They can choose to do something with it or not, but at least the seed has been planted.
Excellent. Also, on her website, she's got under cultured nutrition, there's culturing instructions there. There's just recipes. There's just all kinds of information. You can actually, if you've never had cultured vegetables before and you want to know what they taste like and you don't feel too adventurous, you can just go ahead and buy some from Caroline. They've got those available. And there's videos there. It's just great, great information, great pictures. You can kind of see visually what some of these look like, so that's helpful too. What else would you like them to know about your website?
Well, I think if you go to the homepage, there is a link to a couple of links on there. The first one would be to Dr. Mercola's interview about cultured foods. I think that's something that, along with Donna's archives, you can get a lot of these great interviews on Mercola's website, too. So those are two great resources.
That's
and
a very good interview. That's how I found you. I had not heard of you before until that interview, and that's how I tracked you down. And I thought it was a really, really good interview, and they covered even different stuff. I mean, you think we've covered it all, but you guys covered even different stuff. You told some of your testimony, which I thought was really, really good, and you had a similar experience to me in that we both did some time as vegetarians, and neither one of us found that it worked out for us, you know?
Absolutely.
But the Mercola interview is a really good interview. I would highly recommend people listen to that one.
And then we have a YouTube channel, and under that Mercola interview box on the homepage, right under my picture, you'll see Watch Us on YouTube. And if you go to that channel, that's our official Immunutrition TV YouTube channel. And there you'll see a bunch of different videos about cultured foods that we, again, touch on different things there with my friend Tamara from Real Food, Real Life. And we also have a visual video of how to make cultured foods. We go through it. It's a lot of fun. It's a quick-moving video, so you may want to watch it a couple times. It's kind of a modern editing job, but it's fun and it keeps your attention. So there's that.
Sounds great.
I'm sorry, I put myself on mute a second to
That's
get
okay.
a big cough.
Yeah, it's okay.
Okay, so can we move into what cultures what?
You bet. Let's do it.
All righty.
We
All
have
right,
20 minutes left.
Yay, that's perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, salsa. Now, the book I recommend for all your kitchen needs is Nourishing Traditions.
Yes, I agree.
It is the cookbook that challenges all the politically correct nutrition and diet dictocrats. I just love what that's the saying in front
that.
Of the book.
I know, I
and
love
that. It's written by Sally Fallon Morrell, and she is a wonderful lady, an acquaintance of mine as well, and I just admire her so much. She is the founder and president of the Weston A. Price Foundation. And in her book, she has tons of different fermented vegetables and fruit recipes. I mean, there's some really interesting things in here, like sweet potato fly. I don't know if you've seen that one, Donna.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool. And so,
yes.
You know, you can ferment, you can make ginger beer and, I mean, taro root beverages. And you've got to get this book. I think every chef and every parent should have this book.
I agree. Every household should have it. We also, Sally was also a guest on our,
that's right,
our Blog Talk Radio. So you can scroll down through the archives and find that also and listen to that.
I know that went over very well. You had a lot of wonderful comments on that.
Yeah,
so,
good.
Yeah, so on page 103 of Nourishing Traditions, there's a salsa recipe. And I'm not going to reinvent the wheel here, but if you want to use, you can use whey for your salsa, or you could use a culture powder for your salsa, or you could use a liquid activator. So they overlap. Salsa would be, it's great. We love it with that lime mint liquid from Real Food Real Life. We absolutely love it with that because the lime flavor goes so well with the salsa. And you're going to, and so I'm not going to go through all the ingredients here because you really need to get the book. And we don't have time to go through each recipe like that. But salsa, you can use the whey, the culture powder, or the culture liquid. And salsa is very easy to make. Chop up some tomatoes, onion, chili pepper, some cilantro, maybe even some oregano in there. Use lemon or limes or the lime mint liquid, a little sea salt, and you're going to add some whey in. And usually you're going to make quart size portions. I recommend that you make some up because it'll go fast. So make a quart or two, and then you're going to add in some water to top it off. Remember, even your salsa, your tomatoes, and all that ingredients need to be under the brine. So salsa can use either one of those three activators I just mentioned. Mustard. Now, as Donna said, mustard used to be a fermented food. Now they just add vinegar. Okay, so let's make real mustard, and there's such an easy way to do that. On page 104 of the Nourishing Traditions cookbook, it calls for some ground mustard, whey. You could also use a liquid or a powder starter. You would not use kefir water or kefir dairy grains for something like mustard or for the salsa. It really, they don't work well in those mediums. They're more for liquids. So think of the grains being used for water or other liquids like milk or soy milk or almond milk.
Right.
But the mustard, I have to tell you, if you get some whole mustard seeds, there are different kinds of mustard seeds out there. There are some white ones, some yellow ones, some darker, like rusty colored ones. Have fun, because the more colorful and the more of the rainbow of seeds that you use, the more interesting your mustard will taste, and you'll bring in different nutritional profiles. The darker the mustard seed, the more nutrition it will have. So, vary it up.
Do you ferment the whole seed, or do you grind the seed?
You can ferment the whole seed, or you can grind it up, or you can slice, do a quick coarse chop of the seed. It's up to you. But you're going to, use some garlic, some lemon, some sea salt. You could use ground mustard and some mustard seeds. So it depends on what you want to do with it. It doesn't really matter. I've tried it with the whole seeds before, and then I've tried it also with the seeds just kind of like chopped a little bit in my food processor, and then some fully ground. And it all turns out fine. Experiment with it. That's the fun thing. And do this with your kids. Your kids will love this. It'll be like science in the kitchen for them.
Absolutely.
So you would use either whey or a culture powder or a culture. I wouldn't necessarily, mustard needs to be, salsa can be juicy, so it's okay to use a liquid. I would probably use a little bit of whey, maybe like 2 tablespoons at the most to make mustard. And if you're going to make like maybe a quart, you might not make a quart of mustard, but regardless, you don't want it to be too runny. So I wouldn't use those activator liquids like my friend's liquids. I would more use the powder or a small amount of whey. Even though it's a liquid, yeah.
But you're still going to cover the seeds or the powder with liquid.
Water. You're going to cover it with water, and then you can kind of pour it off and strain it and then have it be a spreadable. Because you're not going to use a lot. You just want it to cover it just about a quarter of an inch, you know, with water.
Yeah.
And then with ketchup is, you know, it actually isn't spelled K-E-T-C-H-U-P. It was ketsup, K-E-T-S-U-P.
Yes.
Believe it or not, there was fish. They would take fish and they would ferment the fish, and the blood of the fish and the oil of the fish made the spreadable ketchup.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Not a tomato to be seen.
Exactly. If you Google that, say, you know, how was ketchup really made, and use ketsup, K-E-T-S-U-P. But ketchup, as we know it, has become this, for lack of a better word, and forgive me, a bastardized version, right? And imitation, absolutely. So ketchup, you can use some tomato paste. We recommend you use the paste because you want it to be spreadable. If you were to use fresh tomatoes, you'd really have to strain them a lot. So go ahead. This is when you kind of do want to use a canned food, but use an organic, properly lined, canned tomato paste. You can use whey. I recommend whey or a powder for this. It's fine. And you're going to add in a little sea salt and a little pepper. You can use cayenne pepper and make a spicy ketchup. A little maple syrup. And maple syrup has its full profile of vitamins and things, so you could put some rapadura in there if you wanted to, or brown rice syrup as well. And you're going to use garlic. You could use honey if you don't have any kind of allergies to honey, absolutely.
Okay.
And your homemade fish sauce. That's where, in the Nourishing Traditions, she adds that fish sauce in because she teaches you how to make a homemade fish sauce or a commercial fish sauce. And that ketchup actually had fish in it to begin with. So she's going back, Sally Fallon, the author of this book, to the real thing. And you're only going to leave mustard and ketchup out for a couple of days. Unlike fermented sauerkraut, salsa is probably just a couple of days too. Sauerkraut's a lot longer, maybe 7 to 15 days.
So when you say a couple of days, is that 1 to 2 or 2 to 3?
Probably 2 days at least before you put it in the refrigerator, and 3 days for mustard. I find mustard takes about a day longer than ketchup and the salsa. Salsa goes real quick. You might want to check it after. If it's real hot in your house, remember, time and temperature are variables. If it's real hot in your house, the fermentation goes faster. If it's really cold in your house, it goes slower.
So salsa might only take 1 day?
Could, in the summer.
24 hours?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, so we talked about salsa and mustard and ketchup. Now let's talk about chutney. And boy, oh boy, is that one of my favorites. And in the chef's class, this is a huge hit along with the salsa. And what we did was, on page 106 of the Nourishing Traditions book, we combined papaya and pineapple chutney together and played with the recipe a little bit.
Sounds wonderful.
Yes. So remember, papaya and pineapple, of course, are fruits, but what are they? They're enzyme-rich fruits. There's bromelain and papain. So bromelain would be the papaya, and papain is papaya, and bromelain is pineapple. These are digestive enzymes. So you're getting an enzyme-rich chutney, and chutney usually has a little bit of onion in it and a little bit of the sweetness of it. So you're getting the onion and you're getting the fruit. And you're also grating some ginger in there. There's going to be some lime or lemon juice in there. You can make it hot by adding some jalapeno peppers or red pepper flakes. Cilantro is a must in this chutney. Cilantro. Mint is a must in this chutney. So you could leave the mint leaves out and use the mint, lime mint liquid with the chutneys. I personally feel that either whey Or activator liquids work best with a chutney because you kind of want a little bit of juice. You can use the culture powder, but I would add a little extra water to cover the fruit and leave some headroom in the jar. Always leave headroom in the jar, like for about an inch for expansion.
Right.
And you can combine, you know, chop up a coarse chop of your papaya and your pineapple, add in a little whey, sea salt, lime juice, tiny little bit of mint, or use the mint liquid, and use some chili peppers if you want it hot, onion, and ginger, and you will let it sit for about 2 days. Trust me, this one goes fast too, because the more heat and the more sugar, the faster the ferment. You could also
delicious. I know that everyone's listening is going, okay, what was your address, Caroline?
I know, right? Exactly.
Your house.
All you have to do is go to this Nourishing Traditions book, and you can do this too. And when you are fermenting things, I just want to say really quickly, it's important that you remember to put these in a warm place. The top of your refrigerator is wonderful, or a warm cabinet in your kitchen. If your kitchen tends to be cold, you don't have to leave a fermenting jar of chutney or salsa or cultured vegetables in your kitchen. You can take it somewhere else. I used to, I have a chimney that runs up through the center of my home, and I live on the second floor, and I used to put my coconut kefir behind my bedroom door next to the chimney. So you don't have to do it in the kitchen. You know, just make sure that if
right.
it spills over, it's in something that's going to catch whatever might spill over if you don't leave enough headroom in the jar.
I've also done it in the oven. I just close the oven, turn the light on. I wrap a towel around whatever it is to block the light, but just the light from the warmth from the light is a great. Sometimes I leave the oven door cracked like a quarter of an inch, and it doesn't get too hot, and that works really well. That'll make
yes,
yogurt
just the heat
overnight.
From the light in your oven, right? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, you know, did you know that orange marmalade was actually a fermented food originally?
I did not.
Yes. So, again, you know, all these wonderful modern foods we have really came from a different place. So on page 109, you can make preserved lemons and limes. You can make a raisin chutney or an orange marmalade. And the orange marmalade is unbelievable. Unbelievable.
Sounds awesome.
And
what about mayonnaise?
That's what we're going to talk about last but not least, so we have time.
Okay.
Now, mayo also, believe it or not, on page 137 in your Nourishing Traditions book, Sally Fallon talks about making mayonnaise, and yes, you can make it and eat it right then, but you can also do a version of it where you leave it out on the counter for a day and you let it ferment. So homemade mayonnaise is so much more rich in enzymes, particularly lipase, which is a fat-digesting enzyme. And when you add it to all your dishes, you can use it with salmon. Lox is delicious, and lettuce, and make a lox salmon and salmon and lettuce and mayo roll up wrap is delicious. But if you add whey, and I would only use whey with mayonnaise. I wouldn't use the powder. I would not use the activator liquids I spoke about, or grains or anything like that. Grains, just think kefir. Always kefir. And SCOBY, always think kombucha. Those are proprietary. Grains and SCOBYs are proprietary to making kefir, water or milk, or and SCOBYs are for kombucha. But the other three, the whey, the powders, and the activator liquids, they can be used for a lot of different things, as you can see with these condiments. So with mayo, I would only recommend whey, and you only need a tablespoon of it in about a couple of cups. So, again, look at this recipe on page 137. She says that when you add whey, it helps the mayonnaise last longer, and it increases the nutrient content of mayo. All right? So you can use olive oil. You can use coconut oil. You can use a high-quality expeller pressed, cold pressed sunflower oil or safflower oil even. It depends on what kind of taste you'd like. Olive oil can be a little bit different in the mayo. So, you know, I personally like to use sunflower oil and coconut oil to make
hemp oil is also extremely delicious.
you know what, you're right. I haven't had that, but my friend makes it with that. I don't like hemp too much. So, but I think I might like it in the mayo. I don't like the hemp seeds or the hemp oil, but it may be good with all the other things that we add in.
The brand that I've used is Manitoba.
And oh, Manitoba,
it's extremely
yes.
mild, and it's got a wonderful flavor. It tastes like sunflower seeds.
It does. Okay. I will try that because I do like sunflower and safflower oil. I don't eat much of them because they're omega-6, and we want to make sure that if we do eat omega-6s that they're handled properly because they're very, very delicate to heat and light and oxygen exposure. So stick with your omega, saturated fats and your monounsaturates mostly, and then add in some of your omega-3s and 6s because we don't need a lot of omega-3s and 6s. They pack a powerful punch in very small amounts in the diet. Everybody's going crazy and overboard with omega-3s, and it actually can upset the balance of your body chemistry. So,
I agree.
But with mayonnaise, I don't want to run out of time here, but with mayo, basically what you do is get your food processor and get an egg yolk, get some Dijon mustard, sea salt, and lemon juice, and put some whey in. I highly encourage you to render your own whey and use in this, and then process everything until it's blended really well. And that's about a minute or so, either 30 seconds to a minute. Then what you want to do is, the only thing in this recipe of mayonnaise you have not added in is your oil, and you must do that literally a small thin stream or drop by drop as the processor is going. Why? Because you want the oil to break up into tiny, bitty, bitty fatty acids and get emulsified so they stay suspended within the other ingredients. And, you know, you can keep your motor running on your food processor and just take that top out and then pour slightly or drip, 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 drip.
Yes, drip, and drip, drip would be the method.
It really would be. And then
if you do it too fast, it just becomes a liquid. It doesn't emulsify. So you really want to drip, drip, drip.
Yes, drip, drip, drip. And also, when you put it in a mason jar, cover it and leave it out for about 7 to 8 hours before refrigerating. And then, because what it'll do, it'll keep the mayonnaise longer and it won't separate and it'll become firmer over time, even in the refrigerator. So adding that whey and making it a lacto-fermented food, even though it's a short ferment for 7 hours, mayo is just so much better and it lasts so much longer.
Yeah. Well, Caroline, we're down to 2 minutes here. I just want to thank you again. You're just such a wonderful resource for information. This has been excellent. I know that we're going to get great feedback on this. And I want people to think about all of these foods that they've been eating all their life, mustard, mayonnaise, ketchup, you know, salsa, sauerkraut, all these things that we've been eating have been artificial, and you're essentially causing a deficiency in your body by doing that. And we've done it unwittingly, unknowingly. It's because we were trained by the manufacturers to eat this way. But imagine putting all these back into your diet as real foods again. And imagine the amazing levels of probiotics that you're then adding back into your diet.
And digestive support.
It makes a profound difference in your health. I've seen people who had chronic issues that you just couldn't get them stabilized, and you got things in them like kombucha, and 6 weeks, 2 months later, suddenly their system is balancing. And there's nothing that will replace that. There's no... You know, it's like there's nothing that replaces water. When you need water, you have to have water, you know. If you don't have these probiotics, there is no substitute. There, you know, you have to have these in your diet to really have optimal health in your body. And so I want people to really think about just adding this, you know, over time. You don't have to rush into the weekend and make all of these at once, but just maybe once a week, you know, experiment with one of these items. And we have less than a minute, so I just want to thank you again, Caroline, for being here.
And I just want to say one quick thing.
Yes.
Don't forget about yogurt. You know,
yes,
yogurt, but it needs a yogurt starter. So that's completely different, like kefir, grains, and the kombucha SCOBY. I just wanted to mention that real quick.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've done yogurt. It just takes a tablespoon or two out of store-bought yogurt and put it into your milk, your raw milk or whatever. Again, put it in the oven with the light on, and by the next day it'll be yogurt. It's very easy.
And the oven is off, not on.
Yes,
just the
oven is off. just the light in the oven is on. That's it. So we're down to like 20 seconds. So thank you, Caroline. This was
awesome.
Thank
you, Donna.
Had a great time. Wonderful information. Thank you to everyone listening. Stay tuned. While you're there, you see my little smiling face there, click on the follow link and get hooked up with us. And we'll see you next time. God bless you.
Bye-bye, everybody.